The top story is at least one civilian is killed after Saudi Arabia launches an airstrike on Yemen's Sana'a province. Ukraine's defense minister says the probability of a major escalation with Russia is low despite the U.S. allegation of an imminent Russian invasion. And a major strike paralyzes most of Paris metro network and the train grid, disrupting daily commutes of millions of people as workers demand pay hikes. My name is Arash Zahidi. Welcome. Saudi Arabia launches yet another airstrike on Yemen, this time targeting Sana'a province. At least one civilian was killed in the latest attack that took place in the early hours of Friday. It followed another strike that hit Hajjah province. No reports have come out about the Hajjah attack. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a war on Yemen in March of 2015, devastating the country's key infrastructure. The conflict has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead, mostly civilians. Millions more have been displaced, while half of the population face hunger. The UN says Yemen is now the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. The UN warns that millions of Yemenis face more cuts in humanitarian aid in coming months because of the funding shortages that could reduce food rations in the war-torn nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports.
The United Nations aid chief Martin Griffiths said the humanitarian operations in Yemen is about to start doing a lot less. In his latest briefing to the UN Security Council, he warned that the aid agencies are quickly running out of money, forcing them to slash life-saving programs. His remarks has sparked harsh reactions in Yemen.
The UN's decision to cut humanitarian aid threatens the lives of millions of Yemenis. The United Nations is subject to the conditions of donors, most of whom are from the countries of the Saudi-led coalition, and therefore they are politicizing humanitarian aid to achieve what they have failed militarily. The United Nations describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and Yemenis have been suffering since the beginning of the war, and the UN aid is already scarce.
Since January, the World Food Programme has reduced rations for 8 million of the 13 million Yemenis it feeds each month. Griffiths said rations may be cut further from March or even stopped, meaning that millions of Yemenis may die of hunger.
When we see the reality and what is happening on the ground and how the Yemeni army continues to achieve victories in various battlefronts, we realize that the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its declared goals, and therefore they are seeking to put pressure on the Yemeni army by reducing humanitarian aid to the country. Reports confirm the high rate of death among children, and this confirms the failure of the United Nations humanitarian operation in Yemen.
The reduction in food rations comes with millions of people in Yemen facing starvation as a result of the ongoing years-long Saudi war and the blockade imposed on their country.
As observers say, the United Nations may announce a death sentence for millions of Yemenis if gaps in its funding are not filled. They warn that if the world body wants to save more lives in Yemen, it must reduce the operational expenses of its agencies that deplete the humanitarian funding. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Israeli forces clash with Palestinians in a village near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Nearly two dozen Palestinians were injured. Palestinian media say they were protesting the visit of a group of Israeli settlers to their village. Elsewhere in the West Bank, Israeli forces have stopped hundreds of Palestinians near a checkpoint in Ramallah, preventing them from heading to Al-Aqsa Mosque. Situation is tense across the occupied West Bank amid an Israeli crackdown that is in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Al-Quds city. Anger boils after a far-right Israeli lawmaker opened an office in the neighborhood at the weekend. Two Palestinians have been killed during the ensuing demonstrations. Last year, Sheikh Jarrah was also tense over planned evictions of a number of Palestinian families. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil gives us details about the clashes near Nablus.
There was a call from settlers' organizations to head to Nablus, specifically to Sbeh Mountain in the village of Beita. This area that witnessed numerous clashes and ongoing protests and demonstrations against the building of an illegal settlement there. What happened today is that there was a call by the settlers' group to tour the area by the settlers and settlers' officials as well. That's why Palestinians from the village of Beita and the villages surrounding headed to Sbeh Mountain and performed the Fajr prayers there. After that, there were clashes between the Palestinians and the Israeli settlers that, of course, the Israeli soldiers rushed to the area to make sure they would be protecting the Israeli settlers there. As you have mentioned, some 2,000 Palestinians were wounded in that area.
In Albania, concerns are rising over the criminal activities of the anti-Iran terrorist group known as the Mojahedin e Khalq organization. A judicial document leaked by Albanian media says that as an MKO member has been prosecuted for robbing stores. The document says the MKO member has admitted to robbing a bar and a pharmacy last year. The document specifies the member has previous convictions. The latest controversy comes 2 months after reports emerged that other MKO members based in a camp near the capital, Tirana, were involved in human trafficking and drug smuggling between 2019 and 2021. The Albanian media, that is, say the country's police have alerted the U.S. Embassy of the group's involvement in criminal activities. The Albanian police deny sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating further. Critics in Albania blame the U.S. for providing protection for the terrorist cult. The U.S. removed the MKO from its terror blacklist in 2012. The group now enjoys freedom of activity in the U.S. and Europe and even holds regular meetings where European and American officials make speeches. Olsi Jazeksi is an Albanian historian and social activist. He joined us earlier to provide more details over the latest controversy surrounding the MKO terror group. He says the MKO, supported by the U.S. Embassy, frequently bribes or blackmails Albanian prosecutors and police to escape prosecution.
Reports have been leaked from Albanian police where a number of high commanders of the Mujahideen command, people like Narges Abrishamci, who is the sister-in-law of Mariam Rajavi and the sister of her first husband, Mehdi Abrishamci, and other top commanders of the Mujahideen, they have been arrested for smuggling drugs to Italy. Other commanders have been arrested for taking illegal refugees from Greece and sending them to Italy and then to France. We don't know who these people are. They can be jihadi fighters of Daesh and ISIS. They can be suicide bombers. They can be people who have committed huge human rights violations and crimes in Syria. And this is so worrying for the Albanian government, the Albanian police. Now, the case against the Mujahideens has been continuing for a number of years in Albania, but in the past, Mujahideens have been very good on bribing our prosecutors, on using the U.S. Embassy in Albania to blackmail Albanian prosecutors, judges, and police. But now this issue has exploded because this is huge.
While the West keeps accusing Russia of planning to invade Ukraine, Kyiv itself sees the probability of a large-scale escalation as low. That's what Ukraine's defense minister has told Parliament. Neighboring Russia also says it's withdrawing more troops and equipment from near Ukraine's borders, citing the presence of Russian forces there. The U.S. and NATO have been insisting for weeks that Russia wants to attack Ukraine. Moscow denies the allegation. In the meantime, it has expressed concern Over the latest flare-up in eastern Ukraine between pro-Russian fighters and government troops, both sides have accused one another of shelling and mortar attacks and thus violating a ceasefire in place since February of 2015. The pro-Russian forces based in the Donbas region seek independence from Ukraine. Transport workers go on a major strike in Paris, bringing most of the city's subway network to a halt. 8 metro lines are completely out of service, while 6 others are operating only partially. The French transport minister has called on companies to make maximum use of working from home while the walkouts continue. Employees of RATP, the Paris rail and metro system, are unhappy with their wage hike this year. The government has offered to increase their pay by 2.7%, but they are demanding 3%. The French capital has been hit by a number of major strikes in the transport sector in the past few years. Police in Canada detain a number of demonstrators in the capital, Ottawa, as truckers and their supporters continue to block roads to protest against COVID-19 restrictions. The arrests come less than 2 hours after the city's police chief warned protesters of imminent action to clear them from downtown Ottawa. Truckers opposing COVID vaccine mandates, known as the Freedom Convoy, have blocked roads in the capital's downtown area for nearly 3 weeks and temporarily shut border crossings with the United States. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has warned that the move is threatening public safety and damaging the country's economy. Earlier, we spoke to international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, who briefed us on efforts by the Canadian government to put an end to the anti-vaccine demonstrations.
The government is, for the first time, invoking the Emergency Act. It's never been used before, so it still has to be explored and tested. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association is launching a challenge to the court, saying that to the law, saying that it's unconstitutional and it is not proportional. You have there's some argument to say that this is maybe an overreaction on the part of the government, but the law is the government invokes it, then it has to be debated, and the debate's going to take place on Monday. If the parliament passes it, it maintains it. If they reject it, then the law ends. It's only enforced for 30 days, but it does allow seizure of bank accounts, seizure of trucks, taking away driver's licenses. Also, it prevents children from being involved, because there's a lot of children actually living in the trucks and staying with the protesters. And it prevents people from providing fuel, food, and other material assistance to the truckers.
People in the U.S. city of Minneapolis hold a funeral for Amir Locke, a young black man killed at the hands of police earlier this month. Hundreds, including friends and family members, attended the ceremony on Thursday. Anger boils over police's use of no-knock warrant. That's a practice which does not require police officers to knock and give any occupant a chance to open the door. And that's how police acted when they raided Amir Locke's apartment in Minneapolis. Now, his parents want President Joe Biden to advocate for a national ban on no-knock warrants in the name of their son.
America, hear us clearly. Justice for Amir Locke. Justice for Amir Locke. And we're passing that no-knock warrant bill. We'll pass in this name, and it's going to save millions of lives. Thank you all.
Locke, 22 years old, was killed in the police raid on February the 2nd. His death is the latest in a series of incidents involving U.S. police and leading to fatalities among African Americans. Those deaths have further ignited anger at racial discrimination. In the U.S., where protests have taken place calling for equality, the calls have been growing since May 2020 when black man George Floyd was choked to death by a white police officer in Minneapolis. It is widely known that the U.S. has been active in West Asia for quite some time. From arms sales to leading wars in the region, the destructive role that the U.S. has played has caused death and destruction on a massive scale. The U.K. has also been an active participant in actions that have led to this devastation, especially when it comes to Iraq. And the U.K.'s colonial aspirations for West Asia may play out even more once the U.S. presence becomes less visible.
Britain has sought to restore its influence and colonial rule in West Asia by pursuing aggressive and interventionist policies in the region. UK's first direct military involvement, the 21st century, began in Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks. UK officials beat the drums of war. Then Prime Minister Tony Blair, who was referred to as George W. Bush's poodle, played a key role in paving the way for UK's militarism. It has now emerged that British forces committed war crimes in Afghanistan. Documents show senior military officers buried evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. UK Special Forces officers killed unarmed Afghans who posed no threats. In 2003, London followed Washington's lead in accusing Iraq's former regime of possessing weapons of mass destruction.
So that was the UK's role, was to provide cover for the Americans. And of course, the American, the UK sees America as a means of getting a sort of protection, getting the big brother on their side, which they've, you know, following on from their experiences in 1945. The British establishment have a terrific fear of being left on their own to face a major continental enemy.
The UK, alongside the US, invaded Iraq without the UN mandate. British forces were primarily stationed in southern Iraq. British soldiers tortured hundreds of Iraqi detainees between 2003 and 2009, but no action was taken to hold the British government accountable for the war crimes that it committed there. Following the invasion of Iraq, an inquiry team was set up to investigate Britain's military intervention in the Arab nation. The Chilcot report said the UK chose to invade Iraq before peaceful options had been exhausted. It also said the former UK Premier, Blair, exaggerated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. It also said that Blair ignored warnings on what would happen in Iraq after its invasion.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort.
And that's it with international news.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Pay attention. I'd like to use this opportunity to say to you and to the people of Iran, my dear ones, the revolution is an outstanding and unique resource of our people and our country. We paid a price to achieve the revolution. Heavy prices have been paid to achieve it. But the benefits that exist are 100 times more than the prices that have been paid. This is a lucrative business for the people. Of course, the 8-year war, agitations and sanctions were the prices that we paid. All these things are the prices that the revolution that the revolution paid. But there are profits on this path which are 100 times more than these prices. From the beginning, prices, profits, and benefits accompanied one another. We both paid prices and reaped benefits.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
During the war, our youth went and were martyred. But the people and the youth of the country made great achievements from the costly war. From the beginning, these prices and benefits accompanied one another. Yet, the more we moved forward, the lower the prices and the larger the profits became. Today is the day that we and the people of Iran can earn large profits from the revolution without paying heavy prices. Today, this capability exists. The revolution has spread its roots. The Islamic Republic's tree has become stronger. Many realities have become clear and many solutions have come into being. Today, circumstances are brighter for the people of Iran. The ground is better prepared and the path is smoother. There are more prices to be paid, but they are lighter and more preventable than the past. There is an important point here. This revolution did not come into being with a coup. It did not come into being with a military move like some revolutions wherein military officers took a government and replaced it with another one.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Midstream.
What the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said during his interview with Al Alam channel about activating the air defense system of the resistance was remarkable. Although such threats against the Zionist entity were not new, the capabilities that the resistance now owns in quantity and quality is unparalleled in the history of the resistance and cannot be simply eliminated. There is no doubt that the 2006 war was a very important historical moment for the Lebanese resistance Hezbollah. However, after 2006, Martyr Commander Imad Mughniyeh said that the time when the entity could wage wars in the way it did in 2006 is long gone. Mind you, in that year, Hezbollah's surprise in the battlefield was the Kornet, where the famous massacre of Merkava tanks in the field of Ikhyam village took place. The resistance has been talking for a while about the many capabilities it possesses, And His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has repeated several times the term surprises that will happen in any future battle. However, the latest reveal concerning the activation of air risk it will now be taking every time one of its war jets or even spy drones violates Lebanese airspace. What really concerns the Israeli entity is that Hezbollah disclosed air defense systems that it has acquired had succeeded during recent years in delivering them to Lebanon via Syria. It is a massive reveal by military standards, expressed through the operation of these systems in a clear and public manner without concealment, unlike cases in the past, which indicates troubling intentions and worrying maneuvering trends. Since the vision report, with its remarkable eye, there is confirmation that Hezbollah succeeded in obtaining air defense systems sponsored and facilitated by Syria and Iran, including Russian-made SAM-8 and SAM-17 air defense systems, among others. The systems would threaten and disrupt the activity of the Israeli Air Force violations over Lebanon and aim to shoot down planes on the day of command. In reference to the war, it is estimated, according to the same report, that Hezbollah operatives received practical training on air defense systems inside Syrian territory. Meanwhile, Israeli security officials recently stressed that the Israeli army will not give up what they audaciously referred to as their freedom to operate in the skies of Lebanon to gather intelligence information related to threats, including Hezbollah's missile accuracy project. There's no dispute that Israel's disclosure of new variables of strategic importance related to the growth of Hezbollah's capacity to new levels would eventually bring the resistance closer to its immediate operational position intended to harm the jewel in the crown of the Israeli occupation forces, that is, its air force. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In an unprecedented acknowledgement of doubting the superiority of its own air force in the skies of Lebanon, Israel confirmed that it had received Hezbollah's messages that posed a threat to the Israeli air force and its freedom of movement, putting it in what it referred to as a finger in Israel's eye, with the resistance in Lebanon deliberately revealing air defense systems in its possession. The announcement by the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, about the activation of the air defense systems of the resistance sparked a debate inside the Israeli entity about the remaining freedom its air force is capable of having to continue spying over Lebanon or to target Syria from Lebanese airspace. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Abbas Zain, journalist and producer and an expert in the axis of resistance news. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Abbas. Now, Israel has warned of, quote, changing trends, end quote, in the deterrence equation in the Lebanese arena, which would place heavy burdens and maybe uneasy risks on the Israeli occupation's air force, the jewel of the occupation, preventing it from pursuing its violation of Lebanese airspace, as it has been doing for the past four to seven decades, whether with warplanes or drones, knowing the evil that Israel always works with. I am pretty sure that they will not accept this new equation. How do you think they will handle it?
I think that Israel will not accept any disruption to its usual aggression against Lebanon. After the Israeli war on Lebanon in 2006, new deterrence equations were imposed on Israel, which it tried to adapt inside the internal Lebanese arena and in the other arenas throughout the Arab world through the intertwining of the axis of resistance. As you mentioned in your report, Israel will not accept any development that affects that Israel considers it during the course of the Israeli-Arab war. So the Israel is one of the weapons that Israel is most interested in while confronting its enemies. Therefore, after 2006, not only at the level of the air defense or the resistance in Lebanon, but at all levels, Israel tried to break any new equation, whether inside or outside the Lebanese arena. For example, Israel's support for the war against Syria and its support of the overthrow of the government of confronting any development in the resistance due to the intertwining between the resistance in Lebanon, the Syrian Arab Army, and Iran as well. On the domestic level as well, the situation in Lebanon falls within the framework of the pressures exerted by Israel for the sake of barter. In the sense of what Sayyid Nasrullah mentioned during his interview with Al Alam TV, is not only related to the issue of air defense, he also mentioned that there are pressures being exerted on the other countries concerned with the Lebanese issue. For example, he spoke about the request of Benny Gantz, the Israeli Minister of War, from French President Emmanuel Macron to not submit any assistance to Lebanon except if certain conditions were met. What are the conditions? These conditions relate to the balances of deterrence and the development of capabilities of the resistance. Israel seeks to barter in this file. In short, Israel is trying to prevent these equations and prevent the resistance balance of deterrence from developing on many areas, some of which are security and some are military related to Syria and Lebanon, and others are political and economic by putting pressure on Lebanon and the area in which Hezbollah moves inside Lebanon.
Well, Mr. Abbas,
we did hear Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah saying that, and I quote here, the resistance air defense force has given very effective results since it was activated 2 years ago, reiterating that the resistance considers that it is interested in possessing any weapon that would enable it to defend Lebanon and the people of Lebanon. So it has been activated for the past 2 years. Why announce it now, though? What changed to make it a necessity to publicize the activation, since obviously already Israel knew about Hezbollah having this sort of weapon?
If you want to talk theoretically, in the military and security-wise, the announcement of a specific weapon, especially in conflicts similar to the conflict between the resistance in Lebanon and the Israeli enemy, the announcement of certain armament capabilities means that there is something greater than what was mentioned that is still hidden. Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah's announcement of the activation of the Air Defense Force without specifying the type of this weapon and how it was activated, left the Israelis with many speculations. But he added that the Israelis do not know how many missiles the resistance has, nor do they know the capabilities of the resistance in particular. The timing of such an announcement, in theory, means that there are more hidden details still unrevealed. Especially since the Israeli media, citing security and military sources in the occupation, has spoken extensively in recent months about the type of specific weapons that Hezbollah possesses related to air defense. Therefore, Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah came along to say, yes, we do have air defense weapons, confirming the Israeli reports, but at the same time, leaving the Israelis confused. Yes, Sayyid Nasrullah spoke about air defense, but does the resistance only possess this type of weapon, or does it actually have greater capabilities than what was announced? This is from a security and military view. But there are also those who spoke about the issue being linked to the development of deterrence equations. I mean, Mr. Nasrullah spoke during the interview about something related to Syria. He said that there are still problems in Syria that must be resolved. And I think that he hinted at that time to the Israeli raids, which could be dealt with differently at a certain stage. And this is what the Israeli media took very seriously by noting that it's possible that Hezbollah has already deployed air defense systems on the border with Syria, which might be activated at a later time.
Well, Mr. Abbas, we did also read, according to an Israeli report coming from the Israeli Intelligence Department or Division, with a very remarkable title that says "A Finger in the Eye of Israel," there is the confirmation that Hezbollah has succeeded in obtaining these weapons, this system of air defense, and it was facilitated by both Syria and Iran, including, the report said, Russian-made S-8, SAM-8, and SAM-17 air defense systems, among others. But could this move be considered one relevant to the entire axis of resistance, or rather just to Hezbollah?
Let us think the same way the Israeli mind thinks, which looks at the region within an intertwined axis. The political, security, and military levels of Israel are talking about an existential threat from Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran, obviously. Any development that affects any faction in the axis of resistance affects all factions. Therefore, Israel deals with the development of the air capabilities of Hezbollah or any party in the resistance axis on the basis that what is happening is related to the resistance axis as a whole, especially since in recent years the fronts have been greatly intertwined, and we have noticed this, in the Battle of Saif al-Quds, like the indirect interventions through unknown missiles fired from Lebanon and others launched from Syria. Even Iraq entered the equation, and Yemen as well. So the entire axis of resistance is being dealt with on the basis of its formation of an existential threat to the Israeli occupation entity in a homogeneous manner. Therefore, the development of missiles that the Israeli occupation speaks about is not only related to Hezbollah, but it's also related to Syria, Palestine, or Iraq at a later stage. There is also a government in Sana'a that speaks about surprises it is preparing for the occupation entity in Palestine, and so does Iraq.
It remains to be seen what kind of a year this will be for Israel. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Abbas Zain, journalist and producer, expert in the axis of resistance news. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Gaza's strong foundation.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, the Strong Foundation 2 maneuver conducted by the Palestinian resistance factions in the Gaza Strip during the last days of 2021 is not comparable to the previous exercises in the past years, whether in context, timing, or objectives. Therefore, the messages that it inferred, whether to the enemy or to the friend, were different as well. The resistance, in light of the continuous stumbling in the issues of reconstruction and prisoner swap, which threatens to escalate again, wanted to make sure that the occupation understands that it is ready for any new round and that it operates as a one man's heart in any upcoming standoff. Now, despite the fact that this development occurred weeks ago, but my trip to Tehran to participate in the second anniversary of General Soleimani's martyrdom, followed by covering the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution on the Middle East stream, delayed this truly important development on my show. However, we never forget what our regional resistance does to protect its natives. So here's the second edition of Gaza's Strong Foundation in this following report.
11 military factions participated in the second edition of the Strong Foundation military drills in the besieged Gaza Strip on the last week of 2021. The drills, which continued with live ammunition for days, concluded amid hot battlefield conditions and a political atmosphere fraught with complications, at least in the tense Gaza reconstruction file and the faltering prisoner exchange deal. At the site of the Qassam Martyrs, which extends over hundreds of thousands of meters in the far west of the city of Rafah and the southern Gaza Strip, hundreds of soldiers in uniform and without bandanas to distinguish their party affiliations gathered, led by dozens of military leaders of the resistance factions. One Wednesday afternoon, the field officers stood on a map and model of the field of operations, showing the military leaders the plan for the maneuver and its objectives before asking permission to launch its activities. Orders were as follows. The combat groups of various specializations will carry out a simulation of landing behind enemy lines with the aim of capturing Israeli occupation soldiers. The fire support teams will have to neutralize the dangers that surround them. The military commander gave permission, and the intrusion unit began to advance in the field through a previously dug underground tunnel. In the field, three tanks appeared, similar in size and shape to the Israeli Merkava. And in the sky, a drone is trying to thwart the attack. Within a few minutes, the operation began by storming the military base. Then the support units intervened to cover the withdrawal of the resistance fighters, who carried a captured soldier on their shoulders. 27 minutes of virtual combat in which combat units trained with live ammunition to use all types of weapons, including heavy machine guns, individual weapons, IEDs, mortars, and RPGs, in addition to improvised explosive devices and grenades. The fighters, who were a mixture of all military arms, showed remarkable harmony and flexibility in the field, which indicates a great progress in the level of field coordination between the military factions. Those factions had joined 3 years ago in a single formation called the Common Room of the Resistance Factions, in whose name Ayman Naufal, commander in the Al-Qassam Brigades, spoke in his first public appearance since he was released in a complex escape from Egyptian prisons in 2011. Naufal said that the strong foundation maneuver sends messages to the enemy and the friend. To the friend, that the resistance has placed the issue of prisoners on the priority list of the joint room of the resistance factions. And to the enemy, that the walls and engineering measures it is taking on the borders of the Gaza Strip will not protect it. The resistance chose to end off 2021 with a number of messages, the most important of which is that the approach of kidnapping Israeli occupation soldiers to liberate the Palestinian prisoners is not up for discussion in the face of the pressure of life requirements in Gaza, and that the exchange deal must take place according to the rules set by the factions, which are prisoners in exchange for soldiers, not soldiers in exchange for reconstruction.
Well, to discuss this issue with us in Beirut is Mr. Ihsan Ataya, representative of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Lebanon. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ihsan. Now, 11 military arms participated in the second edition of the Strong Foundation maneuvers, which continued with live ammunition for days in the besieged Gaza Strip in the last week of 2021. What makes this military drill different than the former ones that Israel seems very concerned about?
Certainly, the military drills that took place in Gaza carried multiple messages in different directions. It was carrying basic messages to the Zionist enemy that the Palestinian resistance is present and ready for any confrontation and ready to achieve more surprises against the Zionist enemy, especially since the Battle of Sword of Al-Quds and the subsequent retraction of the Zionist entity to the terms of the ceasefire and reconstruction, which the Zionist enemy tried to use to punish the Palestinian people in Gaza. In this context, the resistance was able to send some messages that the attempt of the Zionist entity to undermine the achievements of Gaza will fail and cannot be allowed by the resistance, especially since it has attained important achievements and deterrent equations inside Al-Quds at the 1948 territories who rose up in the face of the occupation. This battle was able to mobilize the Palestinian people all over the world. Therefore, military drills are very important because they are an opportunity to test some types of weapons that have not been used in battles before, or in which some technical details are to be tested on the one hand. They are also messages of important morale for the Palestinian people in Gaza. These drills came to say that Gaza is still present, strong and important at the level of the resistance, and also carried a message to the allies of the resistance, saying that Gaza is ready for any decisive battle in which the Axis decides to fight. Gaza will be the spearhead in this battle. Perhaps these drills also carried messages to the normalizing traitors and to those who succumbed to the Zionist entity on the matter of signing agreements with it that would harm the interest of their people and the interest of our nation and the interest of Palestine. Therefore, these drills send many messages calling on these traitors to learn from Gaza. Since Gaza is geographically small, yet it was able to bring the Zionist enemy to its knees and torment its heart, forcing it to find mediators for a ceasefire. Even President Biden himself intervened to achieve that goal. Therefore, the normalizing traitors must understand that this enemy, who they think they are being supported by, will plunder their wealth and will turn their countries into a place of strife and problems.
Well, but Mr. Ataya, it is evident from what you said and from what we saw from these military drills that the resistance in Gaza wants to inaugurate a new character in military action whose title is full partnership with the different factions found in Gaza, not only in the face of the Israeli threat, but in bearing also responsibility of the consequences of any proactive action that this resistance does, as the decision now is to place the liberation of prisoners along with the national red lines for Palestine. So it seems that Gaza is ready to face another aggression to liberate its people from Israeli detention centers. However, will it be able to survive another round of brutal aggression, knowing that the whole world will just turn a blind eye towards Gaza?
One of the messages of these drills was the internal message, as you mentioned, which is training and field interaction among different factions in the event of any upcoming confrontation with the occupation, especially since part of the ceasefire agreement included the issue of the prisoners' swap deal, which the enemy is trying to evade. The issue of prisoners has become a pressing and important issue in this period, especially nowadays, which may cause a real uprising inside the occupied Palestine interior against the Zionist enemy, in solidarity with these people, the prisoners who began to rise up and confront the warden with force. Therefore, these drills carry an important message to the prisoners, saying that Gaza is ready to sacrifice for the sake of liberating these prisoners. In my opinion, any upcoming confrontation, the biggest loser will be the Israeli entity. Even if Gaza bears the greatest losses at the level of buildings, infrastructure, and martyred civilians, but the Zionist enemy is one who avoids confrontation with the Palestinians. The biggest evidence of this is the issue of the Palestinian detainee who went on hunger strike, Hisham Abu Hawash, whose cause the whole world followed, and how the Israeli enemy retreated in this matter due to the threat of the Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad movement, who threatened that martyrdom of the prisoner Abu Hawash would be a reason for firing rockets at Tel Aviv and opening a battle in the face of the enemy's military. Therefore, the Zionist enemy is not interested in a military confrontation because it will be the most affected, and because any confrontation will mobilize our people in the West Bank, Al-Quds, and Palestinian interior, and will trigger a serious intifada in its face. In my opinion, the Palestinian people in Gaza have always been accustomed to sacrifice. They are patient, steadfast, and always stationed on an important front in the homeland in Palestine. They have no problem in confronting the occupation and ready at any time to confront this enemy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ihsan Ataya, representative of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Lebanon. All the support for Gaza and all of Palestine. Thank you for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream. Have a great week.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Javad, the host of this program, and my dear guest and guest speakers here in the studio again, Brother Hussein and Brother Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Well, Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the program again.
Wa alaikum assalam. Glad to be here.
Welcome. Well, we promised our listeners and audience to continue criticizing the movie The Da Vinci Code, produced in 2006 with Tom Hanks playing in it. And we covered the very basics of the criticism of the movie, of course, not artistically, but rather content-wise. And we hope to continue that. Let's take a short break and listen to a part of the movie The Da Vinci Code, produced in 2006, and we'll come back criticizing it.
Above the joint.
Fortunately, a dragon most easy to slay. It's wearing a cilice.
What?
Well, look.
Oh, inflicts pain so he can suffer as Christ suffered.
Oh.
Not so common these days.
Opus Dei. Let me take care of this.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. And we are trying to criticize the movie The Da Vinci Code, produced in 2006. It was, in fact, played by Tom Hanks, the major character in it. Brother Hussein, in a part of the movie you just listened to, in fact, there is this antagonist character, the priest, the albino, basically.
Silas, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he... Silas, yeah. Well, he tortures himself. And in one of the scenes, he tortures himself and, you know, after saying, "I chastise myself." well, in Latin, of course, you know. Why do some religious groups, well, in this movie in particular, Christian monks, self-torture? You know, we have self-flagellation in some of these sects. Some extremists, in fact, try to inflict torture upon their body. Why is it so?
First of all, I'd like to say that Silas was one of my favorite characters in this movie. Paul Bettany is such a talented actor, honestly. He can play any role. So Silas, for example, he kind of represents, you know, those one of those extremist sects that you were talking about. Of course, we have to know that sacrifice is a very important part of many religions, not just, you know, Christianity. And it's not just part of extremism. We sacrifice things on a daily basis, you know, for we sacrifice our rest or time or, you know, whatever it is, we sacrifice it. But of course, the purpose is the most important part. So in regards to religion, the religious people sometimes sacrifice things for, you know, a future benefit, or even even if they don't know when this is going to benefit them. For example, I think Silas was, you know, self-flagellating, like you were saying, and torturing himself.
Yes,
because he believed that, like, you know, in the hereafter, that, you know, he'd achieve what this sacrifice meant.
Before asking another part of the movie, let's take a listen to a portion of this movie and then we'll be back.
Let's cover the talking points again, Your Eminence.
Many call Opus Dei a brainwashing cult. Others an ultra-conservative Christian secret society.
We are a simple Catholic church.
Simple? With a brand new $47 million headquarters in Manhattan.
Our followers are generous. Should we apologize for that?
Perhaps a less defensive tack, Your Eminence. Press continue to be harsh with us.
We are not cafeteria Catholics. We don't pick and choose which rules to follow. We follow doctrine rigorously.
Does doctrine necessarily include vows of chastity, tithing, and atonement for sins through self-flagellation and the cilice?
Many of our followers are married. Many of them have families. Only a small proportion choose to live ascetically in the cloisters of our residential halls. But we are all united in God's work around the world. Surely that is an admirable way to lead one's life.
Then why are some media referring to Opus Dei as God's mafia?
Obviously, some people fear what they don't understand.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. And we are talking about Da Vinci Code and trying to critique this movie, in fact, rather religiously speaking and content-wise. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, you know, why do some religions basically lend themselves easily to different branches and sects? We don't have one, for example, one and whole body of, for example, one religion, and then that's it. But they branch out to different, sects and denominations altogether, and some of them, not to mention, very extremist, radical. I say that because of this part of the movie, that there is this interview about the Christian cult on the plane. It happens, if you notice. They are talking about this Christian cult, the secret society, and all together, and the rest of it.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are a few factors that causes religions to split and have too many sects and schools of thought.
Yes.
One of the main factors is time. With all religions, when the time period between the founder of the religion itself and the followers, when the gap increases and becomes bigger, and they obviously, you know, they are far away from their prophet, people start to interpret their own interpretation of religion. And then, you know, we have people who form their ideas and their ideology and theology, and they think this is what's correct. And what causes that is the time gap be-